RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 234 with guest Mike Leverick, recorded Tuesday, August 23rd, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. Greg is off doing real work today, so I'm going to fly solo on this one. I have a special guest with me, Mike Leverick, who's a former VMware instructor with 17 years of experience in technologies such as Novell, Windows, Citrix, and VMware. He has also been involved in the VMware community since 2003. He is a VMware forum moderator and a member of the London VMware User Group. Leverick is the man behind the virtualization website and blog RTFM Education, where he publishes free guides and utilities for VMware customers. He received the VMware vExpert Award in 2009, 2010, and 2011. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
We talk a lot of virtualization on Run As Radio. It's, you know, obviously a huge topic for anybody doing work in the IT space these days, but I don't know that we've really dug into VMware's particular strengths, because it's, in a lot of ways, it originated this whole marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I think it's perhaps worth remembering that virtualization, like a lot of technologies, has actually been around for many years, even before VMware was founded. It really started its life over on the kind of mainframe environments. And I guess virtualization on the x86 space, kind of its time came when we moved into the previous decade. And, you know, the x86 platform was the little platform that could. It just got more and more powerful and more memory. And it became more and more viable to run virtualization on commodity x86 hardware in a way that it really probably was never possible, say, in the 90s.
And I remember using it primarily for testing different operating systems, that I had a Win311 VM, and I had a 95 VM and a 98 VM, so that you could reset and retry application installs back in the DLL hell days, and try and get software to actually work reliably on all the platforms.
Sure. I mean, when I was a Citrix instructor, a lot of like Citrix courses would need, you know, per student, two or three different machines,
sure,
you know, for the web backend, a secure gateway, and the MetaFrame box. And I actually started off using Connex Virtual PC, which was eventually acquired by Microsoft. That's where Virtual PC came from, in an effort to give my students a more realistic environment. So, you know, rather than trying to do everything all with one box and wrestle with TCP port conflicts between one service and another.
Right, and loopbacks and all that crazy stuff.
It was so much easier, and although it didn't perform very well, if I'd powered up all these virtual machines before the students arrived, it really gave the impression they had four or five physical machines when they really only had one.
Yeah, those were good days. I guess it got a little scary when we talked about using virtual machines as production operations.
Yeah, I mean, I think back in the sort of 2003, 2004 period is where that tipping point started to become more relevant, and people started to take seriously things like ESX for production environments. But even then, which is not, you know, such a long time ago in the grand scheme of my career and certainly yours, there's been an awful lot of change in just that small period of time where, you know, what I used to get students coming into VMware courses even asking me, you know, do people actually use this in production? That level of kind of skepticism around virtualization.
For sure.
But I think isn't it strange? I guess this is true of all technology, that what was once bleeding edge and seen as being a risky venture, we now do without a moment's thought. Oh yeah, we virtualized that.
You know, yeah.
Virtualization first. But people have adopted the technology like those anxieties and concerns were never even existed, but they were there. And it's only a short period of time ago that people had those anxieties about virtualization generally.
Well, it seems to me that ESX really legitimized production virtual machines, mostly because they had the ability to move it from one piece of hardware to the other, created a sense of failover control that we'd even had with bare metal.
Sure. Sure. I mean, that's true. I think also, I mean, vMotion, I think, was one of those kind of, it's kind of a psychological killer app.
Yeah.
That when you show somebody you're picking up Windows and you move it from one physical box to another. When I first showed that to people in 2003, literally people would rub their eyes and go, do that again.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
It was like jaw-droppingly kind of impressive. I guess sometimes I even felt back then that things like Live Migrate or vMotion were almost a bit of a toy that I just had to show them to people and people would go, wow.
Yeah, I have to have that kind of coolness in my life.
Yeah, it's taken some time for that as a feature to mature into something where a real business case can be wrapped around it rather than just one about maintenance windows and being able to do patching in a seamless way. It came into its own, I think, with VMware's DRS, you know, the ability to move VMs around mm-hmm. with vMotion for performance. Now, that becomes a big selling point, whereas avoiding maintenance windows and shortening windows, wonderful though it is, it's harder to develop like a business case around, we really need this, until you can actually sell that as a big benefit to the business.
Well, and the real sales pitch around virtualization, we saw the commercials and things was just consolidating the data center, just with so many machines laying around at 20% utilization, and we were able to roll that up to about 80% utilization, whole racks of hardware go away.
Sure. I mean, I remember, I think one kind of anecdotal measure of that was back in 2003 when I was looking for servers to run ESX on, I was sure short of cash. My OEM provider was our friend eBay.
Uh-huh.
And you were really struggling to find like sort of decent kit on eBay because it would be racked up. And then within about 2 or 3 years, I started to see truckloads of 2U boxes that would have run a single instance of Windows with a single app.
Right.
Truckloads of them on eBay because like people didn't need them anymore. And I thought, is this a kind of secret barometer of the populism of or the rise of virtualization that people just don't have any use for this kind of kit or certainly that volume of kit to run the applications they were previously using?
Well, I also get a sense now that people are decomposing their servers, that they're running Active Directory controllers, that's the only thing that's on that because it's a VM and it doesn't cost me anything. It's not a dedicated piece of hardware. So we end up with more VMs doing more discrete tasks, but each one of them substantially lighter than what it used to be.
Sure. I mean, I think in fairness, corporates and corporate kind of build requirements would often make something like that mandatory. Of course, as you go further down the kind of business into the small and medium-sized organizations, there's more pressure, or was more pressure, to, you know, put on as many different services on one piece of tin or one instance of Windows to keep the hardware and the licensing costs down. And I used to see that when prior to virtualization in my Citrix customers, you know, without fail, they'd ask me, can you run this on alongside the SQL box and with something else, where everybody was trying to shoehorn applications
right.
together just to save money. And I guess to some degree, that's where your DLL hell kind of situation used to come to the fore. You know, the more you're trying to squeeze different applications from different vendors on the same Windows instance, you could almost see a kind of exponential increase in possible conflicts and other issues coming to the fore.
Well, so much software does not work and play well with others.
No.
So
even to this day, sadly.
To this day, yeah. You know, Exchange does not like other software. It needs to be by itself. Heck, it doesn't even like itself. It likes to be spread across multiple machines.
Sure. I think the other thing that's worth mentioning about what drove the rise of virtualization in the previous decade is back when I started with VMware in the kind of 2003-2004 era, if you had a server that had, you know, 16 gig of memory, everybody would go, ooh. And therefore, some of the kind of advanced memory management features that VMware had back then were that much more significant than they ever were. And they did allow you to do a greater consolidation ratio, to pick up on the point you were about server consolidation, then would have been possible without dipping your hand into the pocket. And I know it's fair to say that once memory is badged as being from HP or IBM or whoever, it suddenly goes up in price compared to, say, desktop memory.
For sure.
But memory prices have dropped significantly. And now people casually talk about 128 gig of RAM on their servers as a standard. I've got a customer who's got half a terabyte in each of their ESX hosts. And I mean, that's in a 7-year period or a 5-year period.
Yeah.
It's like phenomenal. And of course, with that extra RAM, means greater consolidation ratios are possible because, you know, there's less fear or worry about potentially running into swapping activity.
I guess the 64-bit computing movement is also a key part of making all that work. That's big memory, big cores, and a lot of horsepower in an individual box.
Sure. I'm not sure how much the 64-bit kind of change drove virtualization. I mean, for people who needed 64-bit because their app needed it,
right?
Certainly running 64-bit inside a virtual machine was so much more easy than trying to get the right drivers onto a physical box.
Definitely.
I mean, anybody who had experience of rushing out to buy Windows XP 64 and then failing miserably to get their, you know, CD-ROM or graphics driver working on because there wasn't a 64-bit driver for it.
Well, and I think there's relatively few applications that actually need 64-bit, but you want your host environment to be 64-bit so it can run these many 32-bit instances.
Yeah. I mean, I think where the benefits came in, I mean, with the 64-bit, I think you've got to remember that in most virtualization environments, when the VM, that's 30-bit, 32-bit, it executes natively on that processor.
Mm-hmm.
So the 64-bits really don't really accelerate the virtual machine. But what does, I think, is all these processor enhancements that were brought in by both AMD and Intel. I think probably the most famous is Intel VT.
Right.
So all this acceleration that's been done at the chipset level to get rid of some of the early pain points in virtualization where the CPU could be a problem. You know, but I guess like with all hardware developments, you know, as the CPUs improved, all that did was expose bottlenecks elsewhere in the infrastructure. So you're constantly on a movable feast of trying to improve the hardware and make sure nothing is a bottleneck across the full core resources.
So do you feel that we're now sort of in a mature state, that the latest versions of VMware and Hyper-V represent, there's not a lot more to do? These things work?
It's funny that you say that. I think there's a kind of pressure to say that they do because the agenda in our industry is all pushing towards the cloud, where something like the virtualization layer, be it KVM, you know, Xen or ESX or Hyper-V, that you're so high up in the stack that you almost don't care
right.
What the virtualization layer is. But I think there's still an awful lot to be squeezed out of that virtualization layer in terms of improving it, but even more so making sure that the integration between the cloud layer and the virtualization layer is as advertised. And I think where we are currently is, I think, in a kind of, I wouldn't call it a credibility gap, but there's a lot of big vision talk about cloud, and a lot of it is short on execution from all of the vendors. And I think that's the gap that we'll be looking to see plugged in the next 5 years, that the big picture, the vision is actually being tangibly delivered.
Well, at this point, I don't think any of the vendors actually offer a give me your VM and I'll run it in the cloud. You have to build it. Every cloud instance is a VM and you have to build your own. But virtual instances are too big. You just can't haul 64 gigs back and forth across a network to the cloud.
No, I mean, I think that's why the current narrative around cloud is very much based on this hybrid model, you know, that some VMs will be run internally on an internal cloud, private cloud, if you want to call it that. Some VMs will be on a public cloud with a, you know, external provider. And yes, they may speak to each other across a secure VPN link, but we're a long way away from this vision of being able to move a workload, if we can call it that, seamlessly from one provider to another because
right.
of the very reasons you outline. I mean, looking forward to the release of vSphere 5, which I think will probably GA within the next couple of days, you can see in the vSphere 5 release, a lot of work has been done by VMware around the storage side of the virtualization stack, whereas in vSphere 4, the narrative then was all about networking improvements, their distributed virtual switch and the Nexus 1000V from Cisco. So if you like, vSphere 4 was a network story. vSphere 5, I think, will be remembered in the future as being a kind of storage story. Although there's lots of improvements elsewhere. When you look at the list of features, you can see it's very storage-rich in terms of improvements on that side of the fence.
I mean, are we starting to talk about this idea of vMotion to the cloud? Is that feasible?
I think, well, certainly it's possible. I mean, you know, if you've got access to things like NetApp Metro Cluster or EMC vPlex, there are reference architectures that show you know, moving workloads from one data center to another is certainly possible. And then kind of on the periphery, we're seeing some of the kind of network guys, the people like F5, saying, hey, we can do moves of virtual machines from one location to another by monkeying around with, you know, the way we do TCP retransmits and acknowledgements, things like that.
Right.
But, I mean, apart from customers who may already have technologies like F5 in-house already and they only have to pay a license in order to enable the functionality to do long-distance vMotion, things like NetApp Metro Cluster and EMC vPlex are like a major undertaking. And it's not just the storage layer, if you think about it. You know, the VM's moving from a set of hosts with an array in New York, and it's being moved to another set of ESX hosts to a different array in, say, New Jersey. What about the networking layer as well? You know, looking at stretch VLANs where the IP address of the VM does not change as it's moved from one site to another. There aren't many businesses that I've met that actually have both the technological but also the geographical requirements to actually achieve that seamlessly. You know, because I think what's often forget is there is this thing called physics.
Yeah, and I think the speed of light is hard to beat.
Yeah, ever since Einstein decreed that the fastest thing was the speed of light, you know, if you're on the East Coast and you're trying to move something to the West Coast, you know, there are geographical and physical differences that's always going to make that a major thing to achieve, you know, unless we manage to break one of Einstein's laws of relativity.
And, you know, computing's crazy, but I don't think it's that crazy.
No.
I understand there's a new licensing model around vSphere 5 as well. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's been rather contentious. I think it within the community it is largely regarded as a little bit of a PR disaster, because when VMware did the formal announcement of the vSphere product, they also chose to announce at the same time a new licensing model. And I guess there's no good time to announce a new way that a product's being licensed, because people just don't particularly like change that much. They're used to a current model where they know where they stand in terms of how much a product's going to cost them. As soon as you change that, it's going to cause anxiety and worries that it may be substantially more expensive than previous. And I think over the last couple of weeks, VMware have been kind of fighting a regard action on that initial announcement. And there's been a second announcement where they actually increased the allocations of memory to the different SKUs within vSphere 5, in some cases even doubling them.
So they're
extremely...
There's not just a licensing per core, but the amount of memory available to a given VM?
Yeah, I think at the heart of this is, you know, Moore's Law is not a new concept, but since the kind of mid part of the last decade, we've had increasing number of cores per socket. And when dual core and quad core came in, VMware said you can run ESX at no additional cost.
Right.
So whether you were single core, dual core, or quad core, it would cost you the same. It was down to the socket and the number of cores. But, you know, we're now getting into kind of silly billy land of 6 cores per socket, 12 cores per socket. And you can see that basing a financial model around CPU sockets is not one that's going to really play out well, not just for VMware, but for a lot of vendors.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably Oracle are a case in point. That the, you know, the old days of doing everything by the CPU socket, when we start to get to the level of CPU horsepower we currently will have and will have in a very short period of time, is just not going to work. Economically, it's just not going to work. And I think VMware have been extremely brave in deciding at the cusp of a product release to also change the model for licensing away from that socket to the amount of memory you are actually consuming.
And they're just thinking that that's a better measure of the significance or the value of that VM.
I think so. I mean, there have been other attempts to license virtualization products in a different way. I mean, for example, even VMware have a per VM licensing model for their products. So you pay by the number of VMs you have, mm-hmm. rather than whether they're a four-way VM or a one-way VM or a VM with 10 gig or a VM with 1 gig worth of memory. You know, it's just a VM. And you can see within the sort of Citrix Zen Server camp, their licensing model is just count the number of servers you have. We don't care how many CPUs or memory that you've actually got. Just count the number of blades or the number of servers you've got in a rack. So So it seems like the whole industry has struggled to, like, well, what's a good way to, like, monetize this? And, you know, at the same time, keep our shareholders and our dividend healthy, but at the same time, not pricing ourselves out of a market. My analogy for this is, imagine you sell gas, you own, you know, gas stations across the U.S., or even you refine oil. And yesterday I brought out a new car that can do 2,000 miles on a single tank of fuel. What would that do to your business model if I only have to visit your establishment once a month or even less to fill up my car to drive around? It would completely change the way gas was refined and marketed. And I think, I know that's a bit of an extreme analogy, but it's the one I've been going for, that, you know, the way VMware choose to sell its product, it's not gas, it happens to be a VMware, had to change because the resource they were using was changing.
And this is just the evolution of our hardware, changing that model completely.
And the another analogy I've been using, or the statement I've been saying, is, you know, really, I don't care whether I buy my gas in pints, liters, or in gallons. I really don't care.
Right.
What I actually care about is, once I've brimmed my tank with all the VMware I can get into it, how much? What's the dollar charge on the display that I have to actually then take my card out to pay? So whether you define virtualization by CPU, memory, a combination of both per VM, what we really should be looking at is, well, given what I put in my tank and what it does for me, am I prepared to pay the charge on the bill? And I speak as somebody who's a European who pays double the amount for my gas than most Americans would play.
Right.
So it's an analogy that plays very well in Europe, because we look at the gas prices in the US and we think, oh God, I wish when I filled my tank, I didn't have to pay what I pay in Europe, when I could pay, you know, half that in the US.
Well, and generally speaking, computing has such a huge return on investment that when you actually do the ROI for the cost of your gear and the cost of licensing for an app, you know, the returns are pretty good. It's just that we don't like being surprised that all of a sudden the product, I've been using this product up to the version 4. Now, if I'm going to switch to version 5, my licensing cost just doubled. That's a hard sell to the boss.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in fairness to VMware, there's been other sales that were very easy to sell. Mm-hmm. So ESX2 and Virtual Center 1 customers got a free upgrade to Virtual Infrastructure 3 at no additional charge. When that was announced at the London User Group, the audience in the group basically spontaneously stood up and applauded.
Wow.
And I was sat in my chair looking around at these people going, wow, they're really impressed by this. Because as an instructor at the time, I wouldn't really get too closely involved with licensing, as you probably imagine. And I, as I said earlier, this, it doesn't matter whether it was dual core, quad core, was also a very generous offering by VMware. So I guess people are quick to forget when vendors are generous and are quick to respond when they think, ooh, that's going to cost me more money. So some changes looked upon favorably, some changes looked upon unfavorably.
Well, and at the same time, you've got Microsoft more or less giving Hyper-V away, just as part of a Windows license.
This is true, you know. And I think, I mean, as a VMware person, I applaud and welcomed Microsoft's entry into the market space, because up until, say, Microsoft and then maybe Citrix getting involved in virtualization, VMware had basically faced no serious competition whatsoever. And I think that's, no competition is unhealthy from two respects. A, you know, it's not good for the customer, you know, in terms of pricing and, you know, but also I don't think it's good psychologically to feel that you don't face any competition in life, because the danger then is that you can sit back and start to rest on your laurels and start to think that, you know, your customers can be taken for granted. They'll always come to you. So I think the fact that Microsoft has entered the market is a good thing, because it'll help focus the minds in everybody. You know, a competitive market is always good. But the thing I've always thought about Microsoft's venture into virtualization is, I think it's very popular in the media and, you know, in the press and elsewhere to build these straw arguments. You know, will VMware eat Microsoft? Will Microsoft eat VMware? When you look at other parts of IT, you know, from a hardware perspective, the revenues are big enough to support a HP, an IBM, and a Dell. If you look at the storage area, there's enough revenue to support an EMC, a NetApp, a HP, you know, half a dozen storage vendors.
Yep.
And I think that's how virtualization will play out, that the market for virtualization is so enormous, and we haven't even really cussed the wave yet, that it's a big enough market to support VMware, Citrix, Microsoft, and maybe another, you know, KBM or something like that. And for them all to make, you know, decent revenue, all of them to keep their customers happy, and you know, for it to carry on rolling on that way, it doesn't necessarily have to mean the death of one because somebody else is doing, you know, better than they were the year before.
Well, and we're actually better off because we have competition and it pushes the product forward, and, you know, all of those incentives to make a better product. I'm with you. We're much better off to have three good products in that space.
Mm. And I think, you know, everybody's on a journey. You know, VMware have got their journey of product improvements. You know, there's no such thing as a perfect piece of software.
No.
And you can see that Microsoft's on theirs. And for me, what I think is interesting is how the different vendors, yes, they scrap over who's got what feature over what. But it's interesting how the different vendors view their virtualization in different ways. So their vision of what they think virtualization is doing for them and how they should deliver it. Ideologically, there's quite strong differences between Microsoft and VMware and Citrix. So even though they're all delivering a virtualization layer, you know, hypervisor, some sort of management tool, the ethos and the vision surrounding that is actually quite different if you look closely at it.
So you do a number of books, including one on Site Recovery Manager. Can you talk a bit about Site Recovery Manager and, you know, your contributions to that?
Yeah, I first got involved with SRM, as it's called, in about 2007. This was in its alpha phase before it even released as a 1.0 product. And if your listeners don't know what it is, it's basically a DR automation tool. In the background sits some sort of array-based replication in most cases, like NetApp SnapMirror or EMC Mirror View or something like that, Dell replication. But what it does is orchestrate and automate the process of failing over VMs from one site to another. When it first came about, it was really being pitched as a DR technology.
Mm-hmm.
Where VMware are taking it and want to take it is into the regions of a site moving technology. So if you've got a data center move from one location to another and, you know, primarily you're virtualized, it can be used to do that. I think going forward, probably where they'll want to use it is to automate and plan out the moving of large numbers of VMs through vMotion. Certainly once that starts to become more current, you know, this long-distance vMotion that we were talking about earlier.
But also this idea of coordinating a move, that a real application is many VMs,
and
you want to treat them as a working unit.
Yeah, as VMware would call that, a VApp,
right.
A collection of vService, I think, was used previously as well. So I think what's interesting about SRM in that respect is, you know, anybody can do a drag and drop and move a virtual machine around, but in a corporate business, what I need to do is be able to go to my manager and say, look, I've tested this move. I've validated that it will work. I know how long that move will actually take, and I know what steps I might have to take after that move to validate that it's working. And that's the kind of realm that SRM is in. It's all about being able to do your DR testing non-intrusively during the day, which is something that historically we've never been able to do before, but also prove to the business, look, we've got a DR plan. We tested it Tuesday last week, and we tested it Wednesday the week before. We know this is rock solid. That's quite different from the kind of old days of DR where, you know, you maybe would only do it once a year or twice a year if you were lucky. And, of course, people's environments change so rapidly now in this sort of, to use the cliche, the dynamic data center. What you tested 6 months ago isn't the thing that you test 6 months later because it's changed so much.
Yeah, you're shipping software and updating versions and creating new dependencies, and they may not have been caught in your new version of the DR plan.
And it's not just that. It's business owners saying, you know that application when we want it next week, please.
Right.
You know, okay, all right, let's spin this thing up, you know, clickety-click. How do you then, in that kind of environment that's so dynamic, how do you then keep up with your DR plans? So I've written, to answer your question, I've written two books on that. The first I self-published and released myself. The second, which was a kind of minor update in my eyes, I actually distributed to raise money for UNICEF. So I did the writing for charity.
Mm-hmm.
And the third book, which is now on SRM version 5, which will be released in a few months' time, is actually going out through the VMware Press. So a bit like Microsoft have their Microsoft Press books, which I've got a couple on my shelf.
Right.
VMware have kind of teamed up with Pearson Publishing to launch their own kind of micro press.
Nice. And you're also a podcaster.
Yeah, I am. My situation kind of changed about 18 months ago. Up until 18 months ago, I was a full-time instructor in occasional, you know, kind of consultancy work, a little bit of speaking. And then I sort of changed tack, and I sold my blog to a media company in the U.S. called Tech Target, who are based out of Boston in Massachusetts. And they have a whole range of different virtualization titles, some on VMware, some on Microsoft, some VDI related, a whole canon of different titles. And that's sort of liberated me to become a kind of, I don't know what to really call myself, a kind of full-time social media guy, stroke author, stroke speaker, stroke podcaster. So one of my projects when this deal went through was to launch a podcast that's called The Chin Wag and The Vendor Wag. And The Chin Wag is just a casual kind of chat with somebody who's working in the world of virtualization, a bit like the one we're having right now. And The Vendor Wag is a little bit more formal. I usually do some work with a particular vendor, WebEx with them a week or two before, get to know their technology. And it's kind of a Q&A session with the vendor, and that gives the vendor a chance to sort of demo the product as well. And the idea behind the Vendor Wag was mic WebExes so you don't have to, because, you know, as soon as a vendor has your email address, they can sometimes like hound you to death, you know, oh, we want to do a proof of concept and please come to our site and we want to do a WebEx with you. And it's sort of a way, I think, for my kind of watchers and listeners, because it's both audio and video, to sort of look at what the vendors have got to say, but at one remove. So if you like, I'm their firewall between the vendor and them.
Well, I think we ultimately provide the service of just helping them understand, is this important to you or not, to save some time making those decisions.
Yeah, I think that the thing I wanted to do with the Chin Wag and with the Vendor Wag is to try, and this is another good example of it, is to try and get away from those very over-formalized webcasts that you sometimes see, you know, like, well, John, thank you for asking such a wonderful question. You can just see that, you know, there's a script and everything's being laid out in front. Whereas the kind of podcast that I do is very similar to this one. We had a couple of emails, we outlined a rough outline of what we're going to talk, and we just go with it.
Yeah.
And it's a much more liberating way of like talking about what we do in IT than having it wrapped up in a kind of formal presentation.
Well, these are conversations I would have anyway. I just happened to turn on a microphone.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of viewed the same thing as well, that I think it's what I've tried to do with the Chin Wag is to bring people onto it who don't work for a vendor, don't work for VMware, they're not a blogger, they're not an author, they're just somebody using the product. So very often it's people I've met through user groups who said, I really like your Chin Wags, and I thought such and such was wrong, and then I turn around and go, well, why don't you come on? And I think they're a bit surprised that they think they have to be somebody or have a name, but I think, well, no, this conversation we're having right now, if I plunked my podcasting mic between us, would make a great Chin Wag. Why don't we just do it, you know, and arrange it at a later date?
Hey, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.